For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
All right, tonight's class, let me begin. Now, this is our second to last class. We have tonight's class, the next week's class. We have a special guest lecturer next week speaking about Yom Ha'atzma'ut, Israeli Independence Day, and the formation of the prayer for the State of Israel. That will be with Dr. Rabbi Avram Steinberg, special guest from Israel. That is next Monday. Also will be open to the public and to the community at large. Hope you will come for that. That will be our final class in our series. Tonight's class, celebrating and commemorating, or I should really say commemorating tragedy. Tonight's class is dedicated by Brian Baton in commemoration of the Yahrzeit today and tomorrow of his mother and of his brother, Esther Bas Julie and Shmuel Ben Esther. Brian is actually davening mincha downstairs. He'll be up here shortly. We've added a new element to our sponsorships. I know it's the second to last class, a little bit of food. And I now realize had I done that for sponsorships in the beginning of the class, I would have received a lot more sponsorships. So we'll do that next year, Mirtz Hashem. You could thank Brian when he comes in. He'll be the face that you don't recognize. And the art site tonight and tomorrow. So I'll announce that again at the end. Okay, for the regulars in this class, you're familiar with a statement that I make every single time that I'm up here, and that is, this century, whichever century I might be talking about, is the worst century in Jewish history. And as we're going through Jewish history, it seems as if that statement is true. Literally, everything that we go through from the beginning of the thousands, when we started with the Crusades, moving into the Inquisition, to the Gzeres of Tach V'Tat, the Chmielnytsky uprising in Ukraine and in Poland, all the way to the Holocaust of our day, every century that we learn about, we can say is the worst. And the reality is the century that we're discussing today, our century, the Holocaust, World War II, is by far the greatest Jewish tragedy, simply in numbers. A third of the Jewish people wiped out, massacred. It's not a day that I need to spend time discussing the calamity or the ramifications, the tragedy of the Holocaust that you are all familiar with on its own. There was a guttural response, a feeling from amongst the Jews. There has to be something to commemorate this day. There needs to be something. The Jews who made it over to the shores of America, the Jews who settled in Israel, there needs to be something. We have to have some form of a commemoration to acknowledge year in and year out the magnitude of the tragedy that took place. And what we have today, Yom HaShoah, the 27th day of Nisan, became that day. Now, I'm going to just brush over that now because we're going to talk about this a lot more towards the end of the class. This became the day, a national day of recognition. In the State of Israel today, Yom HaShoah is actually a national holiday in the way that Memorial Day or Labor Day in America are national holidays. Government businesses are shut. There are certain things you can and can't do. In Israel today, Yom HaShoah is actually a day where the entertainment industry is completely shut down. Certain businesses cannot be opened. The entire television radio programming throughout the day is simply Holocaust related. There is, of course, the siren which sounds at 10 a.m. in the morning, and the entire country comes to a standstill as everybody stops and begins to contemplate for a little bit the magnitude of the tragedy. There are public readings. There are programs throughout the country. It's literally a day in which the country stops and recognizes the magnitude of the tragedy. You may be aware that there are a group of people in Israel today who do not recognize Yom HaShoah as anything of significance. They are generally identified, this group of people, from amongst the Haredi or Hasidic world, and they did not necessarily stop their cars, did not necessarily close down their businesses, or acknowledge in any way, shape, or form that today is Yom HaShoah. That's a reality. It takes place every year. You might be tempted to simply chalk that up to another example of a Haredi secular divide, but that would not be accurate. And what I'd like to do with you tonight is actually take you through a little bit of the history of the concept of commemorating tragedy and to show you that what happened today is part of a much larger picture that actually has nothing to do with the secular religious divide. It is exacerbated by it, but is not rooted in it. And to have a greater understanding of what exactly did take place today and why did it take place today. Like many of you, I'm a survivor, a descendant of survivors. Both of my grandparents, all four of my grandparents, I should say, all four of my grandparents are survivors. My grandfather, for whom I'm named, I never knew him. He died the year before I was born. But the three other grandparents, until about 3 or 4 years ago, all three of them were alive. So I grew up until my mid-30s with three surviving grandparents, which means that the Holocaust for me was just part of the backdrop of life. It wasn't something that you needed a day to celebrate or to acknowledge, to commemorate. It was life. Life was being a survivor. Having European grandparents with thick, heavy accents who came over from Europe, who had stories to tell. And until my 30s, which is a blessing that I recognize every day, not only did I grow up with that, my children grew up with that. My four older children have memories of their own stories that they've heard being in the home of survivors. And it is not lost on me that it is in my own family, my own generation, my three younger children will not have that. They just were too young. And now already, two of my grandparents are in the world of truth, and my grandmother, she should live and be well, but she's not telling stories of the Holocaust anymore in the same way that she was. And my children, it just, so that half of my own children will have grown up in the homes with survivors, and some of my own children will not. And having been at the Greenwood Memorial yesterday, looking around at the crowd, if those of you were there, would notice there was a certain age bracket that's a very strong participant and an age bracket that's much less of a participant. And it's a reality. It's now 65, 70 years post-Holocaust. And what now happened? So there's a desire, a need, a want to do something to commemorate, which is what we have. The question, of course, is how? Question, of course, is how. So we say we have to remember. We have to remember. Zachor is the word that's always, of course, the catchphrase of all Yom HaShoah. Well, for how long? Do we have any day in our calendar to commemorate the Crusades? Crusades was the greatest tragedy which took place to Ashkenazic Jewry from 1096 to the 1300s. It destroyed Ashkenazic Jewry. Do we do anything today on our calendar to commemorate that? How about the Spanish Inquisition, the greatest tragedy to Spanish Jewry, destroyed the entire Spanish community, 250,000 Jews converted, slaughtered, expelled from their homes, the destruction of 800 years of Jewish history in Spain and Portugal. Do we do anything today for the Spanish Inquisition? Okay, we're getting there. How about the Gzeres of Tach V'Tat with the Khmelnytsky Uprising, 1648, 1649. 200,000 Jews were killed, a full 10% of world Ashkenazi Jewry at the time, slaughtered over a year and a half period in 1648, 1649. What do we do today for them? So the Holocaust, as we've mentioned, I've mentioned throughout this course, dwarfs everything. 6 million is the number, is just unimaginable. A third of the Jewish population. It's unimaginable. So we do something. Forever? Do we do the Inquisition forever? Do we do Khmelnytsky forever? Do we do the Crusades forever? Will we do the Holocaust forever? How? When? What should be our course of action as far as marking and commemorating? So we're still in a generation that knows survivors. We have living survivors. What should we establish today that should take us into the next generation? So this is an old question because tragedy is not new to the Jewish people. So there's precedent for how Jews commemorate. What do we do? What should we do? So many of you mentioned Tisha B'Av. Now Tisha B'Av is the backdrop of our entire discussion. Tisha B'Av is the day designated for Jewish tragedy. The day the first temple was destroyed, the day the second temple was destroyed. We've enacted into Jewish law that we celebrate, it always comes out of my mouth, that we commemorate, we acknowledge Tisha B'Av, we actually mourn, we fast, we say kinos, elegies, and it therefore is part and parcel of our world because every year we sit on the floor and we mourn for Jerusalem. So how long will we mourn for Jerusalem? until Jerusalem is rebuilt. Because it's been legislated into Jewish law. Because the Jews, by halacha, will sit and mourn and fast every year until Jerusalem is rebuilt. And then it will turn into a moed. Then the day of Tisha B'Av will transfer, as we say in Megillas Eicha, it will turn from a day of mourning to a day of moed. Well, how do we handle all these other tragedies? Well, the sages, the prophets already gave us four other fast days. We have the Tzom of Gedaliah, the day following Rosh Hashanah, the 10th of Teves, Shavuos Arba Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, together with Tisha B'Av. The fast of Esther is the one exception to that because that commemorates and celebrates triumph. But the other ones all commemorate tragedy, and they're all centered on one type of tragedy. What do all of our legislated fast days commemorate? The destruction of the temple in one way or another. The Tzom of Gedaliah, which was after the destruction, was the last remnant of the Jews being kicked out of the land of Israel following the assassination of Gedaliah. The 10th of Teves is when they surrounded the city. The 17th is when they breached the walls. Tisha B'Av itself, when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. All of our legislated fasts, and they were legislated by the prophets themselves, all surround Tisha B'Av. And then post-prophetic times, now we have a series of other prophecies that we're now going to have to address. Let's see how the Jewish people have handled this over the years. Let's start with the Crusades. Now there's an elephant, let me go take one of those. There's an elephant in the room, which I put in the beginning of our notes. The elephant in the room, which is an elephant which I'm not really going to address, but I have to acknowledge, is the question as to why is there so much suffering? Why is there so much tragedy in Jewish history? If we are all still here, and we're here because there's a relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem, and because we're here to keep His Torah and to spread His word, why, for heaven's sake, literally, why so much suffering, so much tragedy? What kind of people, what other people in the world can get up here like I did and just rattle off as if it's nothing? Well, we went through the Crusades, remember that? Yeah, that was terrible. And then we went through the Inquisition, whew, that was a tough century. And then we did Tach V'Tat in the 1600s, boy, I never thought we'd get out of there. And then the Holocaust, and we're still here, we're still strong, we got our own state, we got our own army. What kind of people can say that? But why do we have to go through that? So the backdrop, we're going to touch on this a little bit as we go through, of the discussion as to how do we commemorate tragedy, which is what we're discussing, is there's a backdrop of why is there so much tragedy? I'm acknowledging that I'm not really going to answer that question tonight. I'm not even going to try. I don't know that I could, even if I were to try, but I'm not going to try. But it's there, and we'll touch on it a little bit. And therefore, the Holocaust is going to be put in the context of all these other tragedies, and we'll deal with that. Let's start with the Crusades. I also, one other point before we get started, I want to give credit to Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who is a rabbi who teaches out of the Yeshiva University and many other institutions up in the New York area. At an RCA convention I went to last summer, he gave basically this lecture in preparation for Tisha B'Av. I was very moved by the lecture, and I have since found it again online when he gave it on Tisha B'Av in a shul up in the New Jersey area, and much of the material comes from him, so I would like to give him credit for a lot of the material for this particular class. Let's start with the Crusades. In November of 1095, Pope Urban II calls for a crusade to liberate the holy city of Jerusalem from Muslim control. Why, particularly now in 1095, does the Pope decide in southern France that it's time to liberate Jerusalem from Muslim rule? Is not a class or an issue which is relevant to us tonight, but that's what he decides, and he calls for this crusade. Now, those of you who have your notebooks, if you'd open up to your map and you look at where southern France is, and then you look at where Jerusalem is, you'll notice there's a long journey to go from southern France all the way around to the east and down south until you finally get to Jerusalem. But that was his call. We're going to liberate from the infidels. There are a number of first-hand accounts that we have amongst our own Jewish sources, which are corroborated by many of the Christian sources, that as the Crusaders, who were enticed by all sorts of monetary rewards and heavenly rewards, pack up their arms and begin to set out, a certain thought occurs to them. One of them is recorded by Rabbi Shlomo Reb Shimon, who was one of the, who writes in the early 1100s, one of the historians that we have describing the time, writes as follows, Hinei anachnu holchim, Hayu Avdan Derech Hayaros, when the Crusaders were traveling, Hayu Omru Mechal Lechaver, they said one to another. And he writes in poetic Hebrew, we're going to this far off land that's going to take us weeks and months to travel to avenge our Savior from the Yishmaelim, from the Arabs. And meanwhile, we're passing by town after town after town after town where there are Jews, the true enemies of Christianity. Asher avoseim harguhu, that our Savior had been killed by their fathers for nothing, and they're living peacefully as we march on by to avenge Christianity from the Muslims in some place, our own backyard. We got all these Jews. So one after another, the Crusaders would peel off, and along the way would pillage and purge their Jewish colleagues, friends, former countrymen from their midst. And the historians describe the destruction of the three major, there were entire cities, swaths of land which were destroyed by the Crusades, but the three major cities known as Arte Shom for Speyer and Vermaisa and Magenta, Speyers, Worms and Mentz, which were destroyed, the three major cities of Ashkenazic Jewry. And we have a record of what happened in Bishmona Be'ir B'yom HaShabbos, was on the 8th of Iyar. This is in May and June of 1096. The call again went out in November 1095. A few months later, the armies get started. In May and June of 1096, these armies start working their way through. They take a little detour as they go through the Rhineland in what today we call Germany, and they hit the big three communities of Ashkenazic Jewry. On the 8th of Iyar, they hit the community of Speyer, and the records record how several of the Jews ran to the local palace, which of course did not afford them any protection, and they were slaughtered there. The band of Crusaders continue moving northward, what's today about an hour or 2 hour drives from Speyer, from Shpira. Many of the Shapiros that we know are derived from Speyer, which was a major Ashkenazic community. They go to Vermaisa, to Worms, and there, Nechleku HaKahal L'Shtei Kisos, the community divides up into two. Some of the communities decided to hide and board up in their homes, and half of the community decided to flee to the local priest's palace. And what happened was, as is recorded here by Reb Shlomo and Reb Shimon, Laku B'Chiflayim, they were struck down twice. On the 23rd of Iyar, just to give you a sense of the time as to where we are, Rosh Chodesh Iyar is going to be this Thursday. It's right after Pesach, about 2 weeks after Pesach is Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and then the next month is Sivan, during which Shavuot sits that first week. So we're in between Pesach and Shavuot when this is taking place. On the 23rd of Iyar, on the 8th of Iyar, Speyer is destroyed. On the 23rd of Iyar, Worms, and then on the 1st of Sivan, on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, the group of Jews which had fled to the palace were annihilated. And then the Crusaders continue on north for another 2 days' travel. And on the 3rd of Sivan, 4 days before Shavuos, they wipe out the community of Metz. So in that 2-3 week period from the 8th of Iyar after Pesach till literally the days leading up to Shavuos, the communities are destroyed. This account is corroborated by the kina that we say on Tisha B'Av. I photocopied it, if it's in your sheets, the entire 25th kina on Tisha B'Av. As you're familiar with on Tisha B'Av, so the first 24 kinos all focus on the destruction of the temple. They all focus on the destruction of Jerusalem and the calamity that befell the Jewish people. And then in the middle of the morning, by the time you get to kina number 25, if you're still awake, we hit the Crusades. And the kina here describes miyitein roshi mayim, would that my head be only flowing water and my eye a fount of flowing tears, I might spend all my days and nights weeping. So you begin reading the kina and you think he's talking about the destruction of Yerushalayim, but as you continue to read onto the next page, the kina is clearly describing what took place during the Crusades. Water, I'm from the underlined part, I'm on page 273, I'm just going to read it through in English. Water will stream from my eyelids, running over with tears as I bitterly bemoan the slain victims of Speyer. It happened on the 8th day of the 2nd month of Iyar, on the Day of Tranquility on Shabbos. They describe what took place. And then on the bottom of the page, in my bitter agony and sadness, I compose the elegies. I remember the murder of the holy congregations of Worms, proven and chosen. Flipping over the page, twice they sanctified the names on the top of page 275. This is again reading this on Tisha B'Av. On the 23rd day of the month of Ziv of Iyar, they were purified, and in the third month of Sivan, while reciting the Hallel on Rosh Chodesh in song, they surrendered their soul, bound up with love. So the Kina describes what took place, again, the destruction of the city of Spire, then moving on to Worms, and on Rosh Chodesh, and then in the third month of Sivan, on the third day, more misery and misfortune were added. The month that should have been a month of celebration of the giving of the Torah, instead was turned into darkness. And now I read from the underline on the end of page 275. Please take to your hearts to compose a bitter eulogy, because their massacre is deserving of mourning and rolling in dust, as was the burning of the house of our God, its hall and its palace. Kisrefa space Elokeinu. This tragedy is equivalent to the destruction of the... Now that's a bold statement to make on Tisha B'Av. On Tisha B'Av, while we're sitting on the floor mourning the destruction of the temple, the Kina instructs us, this tragedy was as great as the destruction of the temple itself. Which in a way, if you think about it from the Ashkenazic Jewry, this was the center of Torah Jewry. The Masorah, the tradition, everything that they had was at stake of being lost and destroyed by these marauding crusaders. So you say, well, then we should have a day to commemorate it, and when should that day take place? Sometime between Pesach and Shavuos, because that's when the communities were destroyed. Says the Kina, V'chi ein lehosif moed shever visav era. We cannot add a new day of mourning over ruin and conflagration. We don't add new days of mourning to the Jewish calendar. Nor may we warn any earlier, only we don't push up mourning, only push it later. Therefore, instead, on Tisha B'Av, I will arouse my sorrowful wailing, and I will eulogize and wail and weep with a bitter soul. So when do I mourn the destruction of Ashkenazi Jewry? On Tisha B'Av. When did the destruction take place? It took place between Pesach and Shavuos. In Iyar, Rosh Chodesh Sivan, on the third of Sivan. But we don't add, Ki ein lehosif moed shever visav era. We don't add new days of tragedy and mourning to the calendar. We have enough days of tragedy on the calendar. If we were to add days of tragedy to the calendar for each tragedy, we would mourn 354 days a year. Because every day of the Jewish calendar would be reason to mourn. We don't do that, says the Kina. We say this every year on Tisha B'Av. We don't add. So when do we mourn for Spire and for Varmaiza and for Magenta? When do we mourn their loss? Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the day Jews mourn, not just for the destruction of the temple, but for the destruction of everything else that comes along with it. Despite the fact that no day was established for the Jews to mourn for the destruction of the Ashkenazi communities, the individual communities of Worms and Spire and Magenta had specific days of mourning. Those communities themselves did establish days of mourning. And we find that in various other sources. The Sefer Rokeach, which was written by Elazar of Worms, who lived in from 1176 to 1238, writes that in Worms they fasted on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, which was the end of the destruction of the city of Worms. Worms was the middle city, the end of its destruction was on Rosh Chodesh. He writes, he's living again almost over 100 years after the destruction of Worms, that he writes, in Worms we have accustomed to fast on Rosh Chodesh. Now he himself lived a tragic life in the Third Crusade. He's still living in Worms. In the Third Crusade, he writes that the Crusaders barged into his own home and in front of his own eyes slaughtered his wife and three of his young children aged 14, 6, and something younger than that. He was injured but survived and continued to live. It's 100 years later, it's during the Third Crusade, but the city of Worms had been fasting, that individual city, for 100 years on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. And he writes, from a halachic perspective, there's a problem. How do you fast on Rosh Chodesh? You know how to fast on Rosh Chodesh. The first halach in Shulchan Aruch about Rosh Chodesh is you know how to fast. The city of Worms fasted. So they had a halachic solution to this problem of tragedy. They had two problems. Number one, they have a problem of what do you lane on Shachris? When you come to shul, You take out the Torah, what are you laying? If it's Rosh Chodesh, what are you laying? Rosh Chodesh laying. If it's a public fast day, what are you laying? Public fast day reading. So the Sefer Rokeach writes, this is the minhag that's developed in Worms. On Rosh Chodesh, we fast on Sivan because for our last 100 years, the city's been destroyed. We read in the morning for Rosh Chodesh. And then in the early afternoon, we make a mincha minyan and we read for a public fast day. And then after we read the Torah for the public fast day, we all break our fast and we eat. So that we don't fast the whole day because it's Rosh Chodesh. But for 100 years, every child growing up in Worms would fast on Rosh Chodesh Sivan and say, why are we fasting on Rosh Chodesh? Because 100 years ago in 1096, the city was destroyed. And little did they know that 100 years later, it would be destroyed again by the next band of crusades during the Third Crusade. That opinion is quoted later. The Maharil was another Ashkenazic Pesach living in the late 1300s, records that in Mainz they also fasted on the 3rd of Sivan, which is when that city was destroyed. And what year is he living in? He's in the 1400s. They're still fasting for the destruction of Mainz. So the individual city, for 300 years, continued to fast on the day of the destruction of Mainz, but just that one individual city. As far as a communal day goes, Ein Lahosif. We don't add new communal days, but the city that suffered the tragedy is allowed to fast. There was an interesting case, the Shvus Yaakov, Yaakov and Yosef Reischer, in 1716, became the Rav in Worms. 1716, this is 600 years later, he becomes the Rav in Worms. The first cycle of the year comes by, and Rosh Chodesh Sivan hits on a Friday. So what's the minhag in Worms on Rosh Chodesh Sivan? They fast. It's Rosh Chodesh. So he's the new Rav in town. So everybody fasts. It was a fast day. But on Friday, they had an interesting minhag. They would daven mincha early on the regular years, and then they would break the fast and eat. But on Friday, that was a nuisance because they had to make Shabbos. So what they did is, early in the afternoon, they would daven mincha. Then they would right away daven marv. And then they would make Shabbos 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That was a minute because they'd been fasting the whole day. So in Worms, that's what they did. They would fast till 2, 3 o'clock, daven an early mincha, and then everyone would go home and make Kiddush and it was Shabbos. They would daven marv, go make Kiddush. So the new Rav in town comes and says, fellas, you're not allowed to do this. You can't daven marv at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday. And they said to him, Rabbi, we've been doing this for 600 years. You can't come in here and tell us what. So he said, I don't care what you've done for 600 years. You know how to do that. And he brought him source after source after source. And so he wrote this whole long response explaining how he tried to convince them to change their ways. And he was unsuccessful. And the rabbis before him were unsuccessful. And he only lasted there 2-3 years. And he ends up as a rabbi somewhere else. Didn't work out. But he's writing in 1716, 600 years after the destruction of the city of Worms, that they were still accustomed to fast because of what happened in 1096. But can we as a Jewish community install a day to mourn? We don't. Ein lahosif moed seva v'shavera. We don't add any new days. The city of Worms, the city of Mentz, the city of Spire, they can if they want. And they did for hundreds of years. But we as a community, we don't. That is one approach, one model as to how the Jewish people have commemorated tragic days. But this wouldn't be a controversy if there wouldn't be a second model. There is a second model. There is a second model. The second model was born in, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this stuff because I don't speak French, but in Blois. Is that right? That was pretty good. In France in 1171. The first model, again, is one in which we don't add. We just simply don't establish new days of mourning. Communities themselves, yes, but not as a people. The blood libel of 1171 in Blois, France, which sits on the Loire River, you can look it up. There are a number of different accounts. We have two Jewish accounts of this story, and a number of non-Jewish accounts as well that all corroborate the story. The basic story with various different details, if you look it up online, there was a Jew by the name of Yitzchak ben Elazar, who was riding his horse close to twilight in the springtime, right after Pesach, it might have been during Pesach, and he's riding alongside the river. And it's dark, it's that twilight type of day, and he's carrying some types of skins that he's going to sell somewhere. I don't know, they were white, whatever they were. Coming along the other way of the river, alongside him, but from the other distance, was a Christian servant. And somehow, in the course of the night, the horse that the Christian servant was riding became frightened at the sight of this Jew carrying these skins in the dusk time, whatever it was. The horse throws the Christian servant off of its back, runs off. Christian servant immediately runs to his master and says, "I was at the river, and I just now saw a Jew disposing of the body of a Christian baby that he had killed to take its blood for matzahs." Old story. Well, at that time it wasn't an old story. This was actually the first time in continental Europe that the story had appeared. This is the third blood libel in Jewish history, 1171. The first two both had taken place in England the previous century. And this is now the first time that it takes place here in continental Europe, in France. The Loire had a tiny little Jewish community of about 40 Jews, and it didn't take long until they had a community of 8 Jews, because as the records indicate, one thing led to another, and 31 or 33 different Jews were hung or burned at the stake. They were basically massacred. The rest of the Jews do not continue to live there. They all leave. Living just upstream, a few kilometers north, is the city of Orléans. Orléans at that time was inhabited by the leading Jewish sage of the time, known as Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yaakov, was his real name. He was referred to as Rabbeinu Tam, was a grandson of Rashi. Again, we're in 1171. Rashi dies in 1105. This is a grandson of Rashi. He himself, Rabbeinu Tam, is going to die just a few weeks after this episode takes place. And in Orléans, he instructs the people, the city of Orléans, to write letters to all the neighboring Jewish communities to recognize and acknowledge this particular tragedy and to establish a fast day. Now, you might think, and this is all post-Holocaust reality, like 31 Jews? A fast day for 30? But 31 Jews, they saw it. That's all post-Holocaust thinking of every Jew was significant, and particularly because of what this episode represented. This was a blood libel, which, as they suspected it did, its concept spread, and there were indeed thousands upon thousands of Jews who would lose their life as a result of this. We have a record of the letter that was sent from Orléans to all the other neighboring cities. I have it for you. It's photocopied. It's the sheet with a page of Beauvoir written on the top. Just going down to the bottom. Indeed, reading it from the English, indeed there are suffering, these are the sufferings of the community through which all Israel achieves atonement. Now that concept, I'm just picking at one line here, is significant. What is that line saying? Indeed, these are the sufferings of the community through which all Israel achieves atonement. This is the Jewish people looking for meaning in tragedy. There are 31 Jews who were slaughtered mercilessly in some little town, but it affects all of us. We achieve some type of atonement of which we don't understand, but we somehow sense a larger meaning in it. For those burned for the sake of the Lord bring offerings for their God and become sanctified. God inhaled the sacred incense, Vayorach es Reach Hanichoach, which is the language of karbonos, of the sacrifices. We offer an animal sacrifice, and the Torah says, Vayorach es Reach Hanichoach, Hashem, so to speak, smells the pleasing aroma of the sacrifice. And so in the poetic language, the letter that's sent borrows that language to say, out of these 31, God, so to speak, smelled that pleasing aroma of sacrifice. Why? How? We can't answer that question. But it's an atonement somehow for all of us. When did this take place? On the fourth day of the week, on Wednesday, on the 20th of the month of Sivan in the year 4931, 1171. 20th of Sivan. So this is now 2 weeks after Shavuos, was when this massacre of the 31 or 33 Jews takes place. It is fitting that this day be established as a fast day for all of our people. The significance of this fast will exceed that of the feast of Gedalia ben Achikam. It is a veritable, should be the fast of Gedalia ben Achikam. It is a veritable day of atonement. It's like a Yom Kippur. So the language is strong. The language of Gedalia ben Achikam, the fast of Tzom Gedalia, a language of Yom Kippur, it is fitting, says Rabbeinu Tam, the greatest sage of the generation, that all of us fast and recognize this day. Our second source, which you don't have in front of you, but I do and I'll read to you, comes from Rabbi Ephraim of Vanna, who writes, and I'll read to you briefly, Wednesday the 20th of Sivan was accepted by all the communities in France, in England, and the Rhineland as a day of mourning and fasting of their own will, and at the behest of the illustrious scholar, our master, Rabbeinu Tam, who wrote letters to them and informed them. Who accepted this fast upon themselves? All of France, all of England, all of the Rhineland, because 31 Jews were slaughtered in a tiny little town in France. All the Jews accepted this upon themselves. And these are the words of our master Ronan, it is proper, and thus did the Jews accept it. Historians argue, modern scholars, whether or not, or for how long did this fast actually last of the 20th of Sivan. We're going to see in a moment there's going to be another 20th of Sivan that's going to occur a few hundred years later. So it's not clear how long this fast took hold. But what we do not see in the letters from Rabbeinu Tam, nor from the writings of Rabbeinu, what do we not see here? No one said, wait a minute. You can't fast on the 20th of Sivan. You need to just wait a few weeks until Tisha B'Av. This is an approach that said, if a tragedy happens and it has significance to the Jewish people, then the Jewish people should recognize that date as a fast day. And on the 20th of Sivan, if that's when it happened, then the Jewish people should fast on the 20th of Sivan. This idea is going to repeat itself 500 years later in 1648 and 1649, as I've mentioned, the Khmelnytsky uprising, which takes place in Ukraine, which was intrinsically not a Jewish problem, although it became one. The Ukrainians, led by the Cossacks, led by Khmelnytsky, uprise against the Polish lords, which had taken over most of the Ukraine, and in their response, we are, as often is the case, subject to their approaches as well. And as I mentioned, 250,000 Jews are slaughtered over a year and a half period, 1648 and 1649. When there was a break in the action in the early 1650s, the Vlad Arba Ha'aratzos, the group of the four lands, which was the leading authority, the Jewish authority, which directed all of those areas, tried to put back the pieces, tried to establish the institutions that they needed. And the record that we have, we have again another record from Rav Nathan Nata of Hanover, who writes about this time, and he writes about the first town that was massacred by the Cossacks. It was a town known as, I think I put it in the notes there. Yeah, Nemirov. So he writes about Vayhi Kishmoa HaMoired Chemel, when Khmelnytsky heard about the Jewish people in Nemirov, that they had Kesef V'Zohav L'Rov. It was a wealthy Jewish community. So he set his sights upon it. And the Jewish people had gathered, and he tells the whole story. Vayhi B'Yom Dalet Chof Sivan, and it was on the 4th of the week, Wednesday, on the 20th of Sivan, 1648. 20th of Sivan, the exact same date that the 31 Jews were slaughtered in southern France. But on the 20th of Sivan, Bo HaKozakin Samoch La'ir Nemirov. The Kozakim surrounded the city of Nemirov, and as he relates, destruction ensued and all the Jews were slaughtered. After the break in the action in 1650, the Vlad got together, V'tiknu Tainas Tzibur L'chol Medinas Poland B'yom Esrin B'chodesh Sivan Ledoros. The Vlad established a fast day on the 20th of Sivan for all of Poland, a fast day for generations that should commemorate the tragedy of the entire year and a half period, which would be, yeah, you have to choose a day. If a tragedy lasts a year and a half, well, what day do you choose? The day that it began, on the 20th of Sivan, is going to be the day that we will commemorate as a fast day for all of Poland. So this, again, is an approach of, what do you mean we don't add extra? We will add extra days. There's a kina that we say on Tisha B'Av that says we don't add extra days. Individual communities, yes, but you can't just add another day of mourning. You can't add another fast day. And there was a second tradition that said you can. This concept of the 20th of Sivan is recorded in all the halachic svarim that we have. All of the poskim from Shulchan Aruch, the Shach, the Taz, the commentators in the poskim, all record that the 20th of Sivan, until modern times when the Jews don't live in the Ukraine anymore, was a fast day on the calendar in all of Poland and Ukraine. 20th of Sivan every year they would fast. Why are we fasting in 1819? Because in 1648, the Jewish communities of Poland and Ukraine were destroyed by the Chmielnytsky uprising, and it began on the 20th of Sivan, and we will therefore fast on this day because of that. And that took place for hundreds of years, until modern times. They would fast. It's written in all the Svarim that we have, record the fast of the 20th of Sivan. And that are the two basic traditions that we have. That brings us to the Holocaust. Two traditions, both of which are going to come up regularly in our discussions as to what should we do. Now, let's fast forward. It's 1942. Word is beginning to leak out about what's taking place throughout Europe. Again, the 1940s, late 30s was not a day and age like we live in today with email and instant information. It took time for the world to learn about the atrocities that were taking place. 1942 begins to leak out. And it leaks to the land of Palestine. It's not yet Israel because that's not until 1948. But the Jews, as we've been studying from past weeks, are already a significant presence in the land of Palestine. They have infrastructure. There's a chief rabbinate. First chief rabbi had been Rabbi Cook, excellent. Those of you who are still some of those classes. Rabbi Cook dies in the 1930s. In 1937, the second chief rabbi is appointed. That's Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, whose name has been perpetuated. Many of his sons and grandsons have been very influential in Israeli politics and the rabbinate since his death. And of course, he's famous from the wine as well. But he was the first chief rabbi from 1937 until 1939, let's say, to 1957, which means from the state of Palestine until it becomes the state of Israel, and for almost 10 years following that. And he is the chief rabbi during the war years. 1942, word begins to leak out as to what's taking place. I just want to share with you before I'll share the story first. Rabbi Wein tells a story. What would be a class if I didn't mention or quote Rabbi Wein? Rabbi Wein tells a story that when he was a little boy in Chicago, when he was 11 years old, Rabbi Herzog came to Chicago. This is now post the war. I think it was 1948, 49. I believe it was after the state had been established, and he came to raise funds for the Jews of people who were in shambles. So he came to the States to gather support. So he came to Chicago. So Rabbi Wein's father was a Rav in the city. So Rabbi Wein tells the story that he remembers his father waking him up early in the morning to go to the airport to pick up Rabbi Herzog from the airport. And he describes that you used to actually walk out to the runway where the planes came in, and they greeted him as he walked off of the plane, and all the rabbanim of the city were there, and they went back to the yeshiva, and they had a very large gathering, and he spoke, and then he spoke to the actual yeshiva boys. He spoke to the kids, the boys in the yeshiva. Rabbi Herzog, Rabbi Wein tells us, he told the story in Or Yisrael, in the yeshiva here, when he came in November to speak to us in this class. He opened up our course, so he spoke in all the different, a lot of the institutions. He told the story in Or Yisrael when he was there. So Rabbi Herzog gets up and he speaks to the boys, and he says that after the war he had received a list of 10,000 Jewish children who had been placed in monasteries and with other Christian families during the war in Europe. And he actually had a list of the children, of who they were, and some of them where they had been given, general areas. And he tried to get an audience with Pope Pius XII. Who history has been very wishy-washy about, if he was a total wicked person during the war, if he was not so bad, if he was good. Not our discussion for tonight. And he got an audience with him. And he presents the Pope with a list of 10,000 Jewish names. It's right after the war. And he says to the Pope, he says, "These are my children. 6 million of us were lost, 1.5 million children. I got 10,000 names that survived. They're in your monasteries. I need them back." And Herzog told the students in front of him, he said, "I'm not giving them to you. I can't. It goes against my belief system. It's against my religion. In my religion, once a child's been baptized, they're baptized for life. I won't give you a single child." Rabbi Herzog told the story to the boys in Chicago. And he tells the story, and Rabbi Wein, as he tells the story, says when he finished telling that story, he put his head down on the shtender, and he wept. And he cried. Rabbi Wein says he cried like a man I had never seen cry before. He cried the tears of 6 million. He cried the tears of all of those children, the 1.5 million children, the 10,000 who were alive and well, that he couldn't get his hands on. And he cried. And when he finished crying, he looked up at the boys and he said, I can't help those children. There's nothing left that I can do for them. But what are you going to do for them? He said to them. What are you going to become? What are you going to do for the Jewish people? You're alive and well here in Chicago, in the United States of America, safe from everything that happened. There are 10,000 children in monasteries who are stuck. What are you going to become? And Rabbi Wein says, I remember that speech until this very day. What are you going to become to save those 10,000 children? That's Rabbi Herzog. So Rabbi Herzog in 1942, as words beginning to leak out, sets up a meeting with the Brisker Rav, Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik was the scion of the Soloveitchik dynasty from Volozhin. He was born in Volozhin. He said if he was a Rosh Hashiva, a very, very prominent figure then, as is his family still today in Yerushalayim. And he sets up a meeting with him about establishing a day of mourning. Till 1942, and he sets up a meeting. Can we establish a day of mourning here in Eretz Yisrael for the tragedy that's taking place throughout Europe? The Brisker Rav's response is recorded from one of his students, who's Rabbi Sheinberg, who has a shul in Harnof, and he writes in his own shuva, he records this conversation, and the Brisker Rav responded, Osir lahosif al yamei ha'evel. It is forbidden to add any days of mourning to the Jewish calendar. Rav Herzog asked him, what's your source? And the Brisker Rav answered, Tisha B'Av. He said, what is my source? We say it every year. And the Brisker Rav quoted for him, V'ein lahosif moed sheva v'saveir. We don't add days of mourning to the Jewish calendar. That there's a tragedy taking place? 100%. Said the Brisker Rav. To add another day of mourning? We don't do that. We have enough days of mourning. Not only do we not do that, there's a reason why we don't do that. Why is it that at Tisha B'Av? Because Tisha B'Av is the source of all of our problems. The destruction of the temple, the exile of the Jewish people, the loss of the divine presence amongst the Jewish people. That's why we have so much sorrow. It's all attributed back to Tisha B'Av. That's the day we mourn. That's the day we sit on the floor and cry. And just like we cry for the Crusades on Tisha B'Av, we should cry for the Holocaust on Tisha B'Av. We don't add any days. This position was furthered, reiterated by numerous Rabbanim across the spectrum of Jewish life. The Chazon Ish, also in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Yishaya Karelitz, also refers to the days to establish a fast day as requiring like a mitzvah d'rabbanit, like a rabbinic enactment. And who are we, he writes, a dor yosom, a orphaned generation, to pretend or have the audacity to think that we can establish new days? We don't add days. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the leading posek, the leading halachic authority in America, who passed away in 1986, writes a response in 1982 when he was asked, Rav Moshe, 30 years past the Holocaust, why is there no day on the calendar? Rav Moshe answers, Tisha B'Av. And he quotes the same Kina 25, Ein Lehosif Moed. We don't add more days, says Rav Moshe. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Rav, the YU Rosh Yeshiva, himself, also felt strongly there should be no such thing as a Yom HaShoah. There should be no Holocaust Day, because when is the day that we commemorate the tragedy of the Holocaust? Tisha B'Av. And the Rav would talk about it every year on Tisha B'Av, and he would teach his students that when you read about the Crusades, and you read about Magenta and Mainz, and Varmiza, Worms, and Speyer, you should be thinking about Kovna and Vilna, and the ghetto in Warsaw, and you should be thinking about the Holocaust. They're just archetypes. They're not. It's not just the Crusades we're crying about. We're crying about Jewish tragedy. And that's why we add Kinos on Tisha B'Av. So the different worlds, from the world of YU and Yeshiva University of Modern Orthodoxy, to the Chazon Ish, to the Brisker Rav, to Rav Moshe Feinstein, the American Posek, across the board, we don't add new days of tragedy or mourning to the Jewish calendar. You want to cry? We have a day for that. It's called Tisha B'Av. You find it hard to mourn of the temple's destruction? Cry over the Holocaust. Fine. Because it's all included, and that's the day that we mourn and we cry. Rav Herzog himself, in 1945, towards the end of the war, was just about over, was asked a question by someone else. This is now 3 years after he asked the Brisker Rav, what should we do? And the Brisker Rav said, nothing. Wait till Tisha B'Av, we'll cry then. Rav Herzog himself is then asked 3 years later, when now the full extent of what's taken place has become known, should we add Yemei Avel? Should we add a day of mourning? And Rav Herzog tends his own response to that, and he writes, absolutely. Do we have the authority to do that? He writes, yes. What's your source? And he turns to the 20th of Sivan. Because in the 1648 and 1649 massacre of the Ukrainian and Polish communities, for 300 years following them, the entire Polish community fasted on the 20th of Sivan. And Rav Herzog says, I'm not making this up. I have precedent. And he can quote, which he does, source after source after source, that the Jewish community as a whole fasted on the 20th of Sivan. If we were interested in a real interesting dialogue, what we would do is we would take each approach and try to figure out how they explain the other one. Meaning, how does Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Rav and the Brisker Rav and the Chazon Ish, how do they deal with the 20th of Sivan? If they hold so strongly that you are not permitted to add another day of mourning, it's well documented that the entire Jewish community of a large area fasted on the 20th of Sivan. And they have numerous responses to that, all interesting and interesting ways of dealing with that. Rav Herzog, how do you deal with the keen on Tisha B'Av? How do you establish a new day when on every year Tisha B'Av we read, we don't add new days? And he tries to deal with that as well. Because at the end of the day, there are two traditions which developed amongst the Jewish people. One which says, we don't add new days, we mourn on Tisha B'Av. And one which says, if the tragedy is big enough, we'll add another day of mourning. And they both come to a head as the Holocaust ends in 44, 45. We have a significant number of rabbinic authorities, really significant, who says, absolutely not. And Rav Herzog, the chief rabbi of Israel, says, absolutely yes. When should we do it? Holocaust is a 4, 5, 6 year ordeal. 6 million Jews. What date on the calendar should we choose? How do we choose a date? If it's not going to be Tisha B'Av, well, when should it be? Fascinatingly, the early chief rabbinate, the office of the chief rabbi, came up with an idea before all of this crystallized into what we do. Very interesting idea. They came up with the following idea right after the state was formed and the War of Independence was fought. And then there was a respite. They said, you know, we've never been able to mourn. If you think about, just historically speaking, from 44, 45, as the Jews begin to flood back to the land of Israel, the people who came back were young, 20s, mostly, orphans. They didn't have anywhere else to go. They didn't have parents, siblings. But they also never sat Shiva. Because you're not sitting Shiva in survival mode in the middle of a war. And then they get to Israel and it's survival mode, and then there's a war. And there was a fact, what should we do for our families? So the chief rabbinate suggested the following idea. We're going to take a week, and the entire Jewish people in the land of Israel are going to sit Shiva. Everyone. Whether you lost a family member or you didn't lose a family member, the Jewish people suffered, and we're all going to sit Shiva together. That was the idea that was originally proposed. It never gained any traction, but it's a fascinating idea if you think about it. For those who've had the misfortune to have to sit Shiva, part of sitting Shiva is what we call Nichum Avelim, comforting the mourners. in which the community comes to offer comfort. Community comes to make a minyan, to deliver food, to sit with you, and to provide comfort. Imagine if the entirety of the Jewish people are all sitting Shiva by themselves. And there's no one to come and offer the comfort, the nechama. It would have been, had that idea gone anywhere, an idea of all Jews at the same time sitting Shiva, but no one being available to offer comfort. But the idea never gained any traction, and they came up with another idea. The chief rabbinate came up with a different idea. Let's choose the 10th of Tevet. Start with Tevet. Why the 10th of Tevet? It's already a fast day. It's already a fast day. So this way we should commemorate the Tisha B'Av by adding it. We don't have to add a new fast. We'll add it to a day that already exists. And in doing so, we'll be able to commemorate the Holocaust. Specifically, we'll combine the two. The Israeli Knesset in 1951 had a different idea. And they chose the 14th of Nisan. Now, the 14th of Nisan might strike a chord for a couple of reasons. Number one, 14th of Nisan, well, what happens on the 15th of Nisan? Pesach. So the Knesset suggested that we are going to commemorate the Holocaust on the 14th of Nisan. Why in the world would they choose the 14th of Nisan? Because the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising took place on the 14th of Nisan. So what? So the Knesset, now remember, for those of you who have been involved in our discussions from the socialists and the early Zionists, there was an idea, we are going to create a new Jew. And the new Jew is not going to be short and hunched over with a big nose and be uneducated and backwards. He's going to be strong. He's going to be 6 feet tall. He's going to be blonde with blue eyes. He's going to be a farmer. And he's going to be a fighter. And the Holocaust represents sheep being led to the slaughter. And that's not what we're interested in. So what we're going to commemorate about the Holocaust are not 6 million sheep who were slaughtered. We're going to commemorate the Jews who fought back. And so the 14th of Nisan, that's the day we celebrate, commemorate the Holocaust. The Israeli rabbinate was successful in saying, 14th of Nisan is Erev Pesach, you can't do that. Now, there's a second problem, that the month of Nisan is a joyous month. The whole month we don't say Tachnun because it's a month of Geula. It's a month of redemption. It's a month of Pesach. So there's no Tachnun the whole month of Nisan. And the Erev Pesach, so they agreed and they pushed it off to the 27th of Nisan, which is a week after Pesach and a week before Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. Right in the middle, that's when we'll commemorate the Holocaust. So it's still during Nisan. And what's the day officially called in Israel? Anybody know? It's not called Yom HaShoah. It's called Yom HaZikaron LeShoah VeLigvura. The day to remember the Holocaust and heroism. Because it's not, we have shortened it as the Yom HaShoah. But it really is a day of remembering the Holocaust and heroism. Middle of Nisan, which presents the following problem. Not only do we have two traditions amongst the Jewish people as to how to commemorate tragedy, the overwhelming majority of authorities, from the modern Orthodox YU world, to the Chazon Ish, to the Brisker Rav, to Rav Moshe Feinstein representing all of America, who with one voice said, no Yom HaShoah. We do not establish separate days. As a singular voice, all those Jewish worlds combined and said, Tisha B'Av. We cry on Tisha B'Av. We have trouble crying on Tisha B'Av. Talk about the Holocaust. Cry all you want. That's the day we mourn. The Israeli Knesset does not listen to the chief rabbi in establishing the 10th of Tevet. The Israeli Knesset puts into law as a national holiday the 27th of Nisan, in the middle of Nisan, to commemorate the Warsaw Uprising and the Holocaust. So not only do we have a large group of Jewish people who hold, there shouldn't be any day. That's not how we do things. So there's a group that says we do that. Okay, so there's a group that says we do that. But when we do that, then we have additionally on top of that, the day that was chosen as a day which not only is in the wrong month, but it doesn't commemorate specifically the tragedy in as much as it tries to establish we fight back, which is a nice idea. Jews fight back. Now we have an army. But is that what the day is about? The Warsaw Uprising? So now I go back and I say, in Israel today, while a siren goes off and shops are closed and Jews are commemorating Yom HaShoah, there are a group of Jews who did not stop and commemorate and did not address the day. Is it sensitive? Is it right? I don't know. I'm not getting involved. I'm just saying it's a whole lot more than simply saying, there's a lot of history. A lot of history that brought us to this point. And now what's happened, because the Israeli Knesset signed into law in 1951, this concept of a Yom HaShoah and a Yom HaZikron L'Gvura, so now it's become, this is fascinating historically, you just look 50 years later and it's Yom HaShoah. It's Holocaust Memorial. Who established this as Holocaust Memorial Day? Why are we celebrating that, commemorating that in the middle of Nisan today? What happened today that this should be the day? What happened was the Israeli Knesset decided that this should be the day. Historically speaking, is that how the Jewish people have decided to commemorate tragedy? Not really. But now it's here. Now it exists. Now there's a day in the calendar that every school-age child knows. Yom HaShoah is the day in the middle of Nisan. It comes the week after Pesach. That's the day. The history behind it, much more complicated. Much more confusing. But my job here isn't to explain or remedy or come to some type of a solution to the problem, but just to paint a picture as to that there indeed is, as we like to call, a Jewish controversy regarding how we commemorate the Holocaust and how we continue to be commemorated l'doros for generations in the situation that we have. Now moving forward, here's the day, it's here. How did it get here? Interesting story. Now what do we do with it? But that's the backdrop to how it is that we got to where we were. So as a communal thing, that's why the original chief rabbinate wanted to move it to the 10th of Tevis, because then it would actually have formal meaning. You'd actually fast. So to establish a new fasting, nobody did. But we did want to, what was established was the Yemei Avil, a day of mourning. That is what they did. It is official. I mean, it's out there. I mean, today is Holocaust Memorial Day. Everybody knows that. It's that's what people talk about. And I'm not in any way that we shouldn't have a day. We made Tisha B'Av, but that's, you're right. It did not become an official. It's a different kind of a day, and it's now been legislated by the Israeli government as a day, and now it's on our calendar. That's a fair point. Correct. So if it becomes that in some way a national holiday, that brings us into all of our previous classes of, well, what if I live in the state of Israel and I'm not supportive of the national government? So then who are they to tell me what day I should mourn my grandfather? It's not a religious, it's a national experience. And that gets us into why you find people who say, I'll mourn when I choose to mourn, which is either on Tisha B'Av, our traditional Jewish day, or on a day of the Yahrzeit. That, you're right. Once it shifts out of religion, and you're certainly not going to tell a religious Jew living in Israel that the irreligious Knesset's going to tell him how to live his religious life, which is why we have the rift that takes place today in Israel. I think that's exactly right. It became a political day. And therefore what's happened is that which everybody agrees to, that the magnitude of the tragedy is such, which needs to be recognized, has gotten thrown into a political mess, in which now, you're calling me not being sensitive. What do you mean I'm not being sensitive? Who are you to tell? Because you decided this, and that's against the religious principles of our people. Now I'm the one insensitive. You made this up. Why am I insensitive? I commemorate them the way that we're supposed to. I agree with you. And it's insensitive. And it's confusing. It's a mess. It really is. My goal is only to paint a picture as to a little bit of the history as to how we got to where we got to, even though it's definitely a tricky place to know. Yeah.
So if it's a secular holiday,
what's the problem with what?
With having a day.
Because Jews, we don't add extra days of mourning. We mourn for we mourn for the Holocaust on Tisha B'Av. What then?
The Knesset didn't ask for a day of mourning. They asked for a day of service.
So okay, so Jews, what Jews do with tragedy is mourn. We do mourn, and we mourn on Tisha B'Av. That's what we do. I'm playing the other side. You're saying, like, what's the big deal? What do you mean, what's the big deal? That's how we do things. That's how we, you know. Now, there are two traditions. There's the Chaf Sivan, the 20th of Sivan. We did create a real fast day. We created a fast day for the Chilmanitsky uprising, and they fasted for hundreds of years. But the leading authorities said not to do this. And it happened. Whatever you can say, there's another side. So
I'm sure
you can argue. That's why it's a controversy, because there are different ways of looking at this. Yeah. The national days without religious significance. Right. It's an interesting question. That's a great philosophical question from a Jewish Torah perspective. Is there such a thing as a national day bereft of religious significance? I'm not sure the answer to that is yes. It could be that, by definition, in a religiously set up society, you couldn't have a day. But maybe, I don't know. I don't know, yes, no, maybe. It's an interesting question. But the days become sort of, it's hard to say that they really, it's just political. It's not just, I mean, real survivors tell their stories and people cry. It really is today. I mean, Yom HaShoah really is. It's not a political day. It's become politicized, but it's a day of mourning, commemoration, and videos, and people think about the Holocaust. It really is a sad day. It's not just, I mean, but again, that gets into also, it's like, what are we remembering? We're just remembering that we were once the people that were hated, or is there some religious significance to the Holocaust? Is, in other words, this is a very significant point, which I don't mean to just throw in your question and answers, but is there religious significance to the Holocaust? Is there religious significance to remembering the Holocaust? Is there a religious takeout? If I go through Yom HaShoah and I say, remember, Rwanda was also a tragedy and we need to remove hate from people's minds because it's a terrible thing. Have I failed? The Jews who were slaughtered in the Holocaust, who died al Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, if they become simply a pawn in diversity, is a good thing. Look what happens when people don't appreciate people's differences. If that's the message that you take out of the Holocaust, people saw Jews as different, just like in Rwanda they saw people as different, and in Sudan they saw people as different. We need to remember this lesson and teach the world. Have I failed? Have I desecrated the memory of 6 million Jews who were slaughtered because they were Jews? I think so. That makes it, the Holocaust, a very religious thing. That makes it very offensive to me when I hear someone say, in the same sentence, look, it's happening all over the world. We haven't learned anything. It's not what the Holocaust is about to me as a Jew. Not at all. My grandparents' whole family were slaughtered, not because Germans couldn't deal with diversity. It's because they were a Jew. Because they believed in God, they believed in the Torah, they believed in consciousness, they believed in morality. That's why they died. Not because they have come from a different ethnic background, like what happens in other places in the world. So that makes the Holocaust a very religious event. Remembering it's a very religious event. Well, who dictates when we have religious events? The Knesset or the Rabbanim? It's a very tricky day. It's a very tricky day. Is there any... All right, so once again, I just want to thank Brian Matan, I assume that must be you. Thank you very much, who provided our food and drink in the back in commemoration of the arts of his mother and brother, and their, hopefully the Shammah received an aliyah from our learning that we did here tonight. Next week is our final class in the course. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg is going to be here from Israel again. He's going to be talking about the controversy surrounding the prayer for the state of Israel. You do not want to miss that one. That'll be next week, our final class. Hope you all enjoyed. Have a great night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.